All right, Rob, thanks for coming on the Aspiring Pilot Podcast. Appreciate your time.
Yeah, happy to be here. Nice to meet you.
Yeah, nice to meet you too. Where we usually start with everyone is just like a quick introduction. So if you could just introduce yourself, tell me where you're at in your career, what your aviation credentials are, stuff like that, be great.
Great. Yeah, my name is Robert Burrell. I've been a pilot since I was 18 years old. I'm 55 now, so I guess where I'm at in my career is near the end. I've been flying nonstop since I was 18, working since then in aviation, and just by luck, mostly through all kinds of world events, I've kept my job as a pilot, doing many different roles in the industry, and currently flying the Challenger 604 out of Victoria for charters and private use.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Pretty much what I do. Oh, and my side hustle, I do flight testing as well for multi-engine and IFR, which mostly is just to meet all the young up and coming people, to be honest, and see what's coming up. And there's a lot of great talent still coming. So it's nice to see.
Awesome. Yeah. Could you tell me how you were introduced to aviation? Like, did you have family members employed through an airline or something like that? Or were you just like a first generation pilot? Like, if you could touch on that.
Yeah, absolutely. First generation. It starts kind of in World War II, oddly enough, even though I'm not that old. My parents are both British. They're both children during World War II in England. And so they moved to Canada, where we're all born, me and my brothers and sister. But they spoke about the air wars and how aviation played such a vital role in defending England during World War II. And it was just those constant stories between my father and my grandfather, who ironically enough was an anti-aircraft gunner for England. So he shot airplanes down, but he still had appreciation. Yeah, it's pretty funny. But I think that's how I get introduced to the idea of flying and the allure of it. And my father was always enamored by it. So he's was a private pilot. I guess he hasn't flown for decades, but he got his private pilot license. And I grew up in London, Ontario, and I could see aircraft flying overhead as I was at home, because I was close to the approach path to runway 27 in London. And I could also see aircraft circling for landing to the south runways. So I had this view of these old turboprops, the Convair 580s, which were quite loud and impressive, coming into London when I was a kid. So I'd be watching them out my bedroom window all night long, and watching them as I worked. I worked at dairy farms and farms in general in the rural parts of Ontario. So I'd be picking rocks and fields, looking up at every aircraft that flew over, thinking that seems like a better job than what I'm currently doing.
Awesome. Yeah. Did you, did you just start solely just to get your private pilot's license, or did you know right away that's something you wanted to do as a career moving forward, or how'd that kind of start for you? Did you just go to a flying club, take a discovery flight, or was it like gifted to you or something like that?
Yeah, I probably took a discovery flight. I guess my first flying was a combination of being part of the Air Cadets when I was 13. Right. I did not get my licenses through Air Cadets. I wasn't very academically inclined when I was 13, so I didn't get that, what do they call it, the flying scholarship. I didn't get that, but I did get to go up in planes a lot. And with my father, as about the time my father had his license, so I flew with him a little bit as well when he'd fly. That's probably my first flying. And then when I started my private pilot license, it was upon graduation of grade 13, which they had in Ontario at the time. And I knew I wanted to pursue it. I think I'd been talking about it through my whole high school career. So upon graduation, I just got into it and paid for my own flying lessons and paid as I went.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
With the goal of working as a pilot, not really knowing how that worked. I didn't know half the things that you could do as a pilot. I knew there's airlines and military. I think that was the extent of my knowledge. And I just started getting my private license and paying as I went, which I think was key because I was never in debt. I was always able to pay for my lessons as I was working at the time.
Yeah, I can relate to you that way too. Like, that's kind of how I've been doing it as well. And when I started, the same kind of view on it as well. I didn't know that there were so many different options, like different routes you could take, different career paths. So yeah, I found it very interesting so far. And yeah, I could see that. Could you take me through your pathway? I guess like after your private pilot's license. So you're doing that in London, Ontario, is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah, I started in London, Ontario at what's called the London Flying Club. No longer exists as far as I know. So it's very much like the Victoria Flying Club. I think they were equally old. The building in Victoria, which is right beside where I currently work, and I'm in there a lot for flight tests, looks just like the old hangar I learnt in. And so I started at the London Flying Club. I did my private commercial, your nighttime rating. And I then thought I could go get a job. So I purchased my father's airplane because he was sort of waning on the idea of flying. He bought an old airplane. So I bought that airplane off of him and I flew it across country looking for jobs. And this was probably 1987 or something.
No way. You just hopped in a plane and started flying across the country?
Yeah, I started flying across the country. I was 20 or 21 years old. And I was looking for jobs and going to as far north as I thought I needed to go. I basically came home having not found any jobs with a commercial license and no experience. And the industry is
funny, though. You think they'd be all over that. That's super ambitious. Like not even driving to drop off a resume, flying in to drop off a resume. That's pretty ambitious. That's awesome.
It was a fun adventure, which is kind of what I've always wanted to do with flying, is make it an adventure. So I was flying and camping under my wing whenever I could and I didn't have any money really. I had a fairly decent non-aviation job that paid for all my flying and I was able to get that time off. And I spent, a few weeks going across the country. That's when I realized there was nothing happening in the industry at that time. Everyone had told me the same as I flew. So I ended up returning to London. Returning to the job, which I was just on vacation from, and that paid for my flying, and I got my instructor rating next because I could actually flight instruct and keep my job and kind of do a hybrid of both things and pay the bills, I guess, as it were. So that's what I did. While I was at the London Flying Club, there was another instructor, a former professor from University of Western Ontario, which I think is called Western University now. And he had enough of being a professor and he wanted to be a flight instructor and start his own school. And he decided to move to Kamloops, British Columbia to start his school. And I followed him out there and we started from scratch. It was called Flight Discovery. And that's really where my learning came in. After years of work at the London Flying Club, a few years, I moved with my friend to Kamloops and we started that flight school, and that was a real master's education in how to teach people. Working with someone with a PhD and holding you to task to really learn your material was quite an education.
For sure, yeah. This is a question I ask a lot of people, but I think it's always interesting to hear the answer for. Do you think like flight instructing played a huge role in your, I guess, development as a pilot? Do you think that really honed down some skills and made you a better overall pilot? Like if you'd skipped that, the instructing portion of your career, and got like a multi-engine job, do you think you would have lost something there? Or do you think that either way you turn out about the same?
Well, for me, it was definitely, for me, the instructing helped. And later on in my career, when I was a chief pilot, instructors are sometimes thought of people who just simply stay in the circuit and they get a little bit of, I don't know how you'd say it, looked down upon when they're trying to move into the industry outside of instructing later. I never really had that discrimination, but I definitely have seen it. And for me, instructors have to know their material so very well to teach a wide range of students. They're young students like yourself, but instructors, young instructors, I'm in my 20s when I'm instructing, and I'm teaching mature doctors and lawyers and dentists and engineers, people who have made a career elsewhere, super intelligent people who are coming to me, this young upstart, to learn to fly. And you know your material very well when you're speaking with a professional like that, trying to teach them. So for me, it was always instructors knew their material very well. I guess there's probably good and bad instructors. Hopefully I was a good one. And I took it as quite a challenge to learn the material, better than a lawyer or a doctor would know it. Mm-hmm. So for me, I guess the answer is, instructing made me a better pilot.
Yeah.
Being able to process that information at the level that I could teach it, is the same process I used through the rest of my flying when I learned different types of aircraft and such.
Yeah, for sure. This is another kind of like a more specific question, but for the newer instructors coming up, can you describe your first experience with like a student and stuff? Like, how did you feel, like a lot of pressure? Did you feel kind of out of place, or did it feel right away and you fell right into that role?
Gosh, we're talking 30 some odd years ago. Let me think. I remember being intimidated by the educated people. I didn't go to university at this point. I couldn't afford a university degree or a college diploma and flying. And so I put all my money into flying. So I was always a little bit intimidated when I would be teaching someone like a doctor or a PhD or anything like that. So I suppose there was that. And you had to teach flight ground school right away also. And so that was actually more challenging than the being in an airplane. The airplane's broken down into skills that these highly educated people don't know, even the non-highly educated people. I guess I was always more comfortable with people in their 20s at the time because I was in my 20s. But in the airplane, it was always very task-oriented. You demonstrate a task, which you're really good at demonstrating by the point of being an instructor, and then you're helping them and critiquing them and breaking down the task until they can do it. So I think in ground school, it was more intimidating, fielding questions that you may not have anticipated during any number of topics that you had to teach, as opposed to being in the airplane.
Okay.
But it just raises your game, if you want to say it that way, and makes you, hit the books. Also not pretending that you know all the answers to all these random questions and going into the books with the students sometimes and finding the answers with them.
Yeah, I guess you're always learning, right? That's not the peak or the end of your training in a way. You just keep going and learning new things as you go along. Yeah,
absolutely. If you meet a pilot that says they've learned it all and they're not learning any longer, you probably don't want to fly with that pilot.
Yeah, no, that's a good point for sure. I've heard that a few times, actually. A lot of people say that. Yeah. Like, the further you get along, the more you realize you don't know and you need to keep learning and staying on top of your stuff for sure.
Yeah, that's why I like about that's also what I like about doing the flight testing. As much as it's not an instructional role, the briefing and the debriefing, well, the debriefing specifically, turns into a bit instructional, and I do like that still. I enjoyed my flight instructing years.
That's awesome. Okay, from I guess moving on from there, then, when did you decide to, I guess, move on then get a job outside of instructing?
Well, I was in Kamloops working for my friend Sam at Flight Discovery. I think I'd started getting a little bit, suppose you'd call it burned out. I was 7 or 8 years into flight instructing. I never really had a path. I've listened to your podcast with Barry, and he was set on being a 747 captain. I didn't have a goal. I just wanted to fly airplanes and approach airplanes as if it were a trade. So after about 7 or 8 years of instructing, you do a lot of talking as an instructor, a lot of defending the work you have to discuss with your students, and answering lots of why questions. So mm-hmm. I felt I was getting a little bit tired of that particular type of flying. We didn't do charters at Flight Discovery. So I went down to Pro IFR in Vancouver and got my multi IFR rating, and still instructed in Kamloops for a little longer. And at that point I told my friend I needed to stretch out and go try some different types of flying. So that's when I ended up ultimately in Whitehorse to do some multi-engine flying up there.
Oh, wow.
And I think a lot of people have mentioned that if you leave your job well, you could always go back to it. So doing my job well allowed me to get that job in Whitehorse because I was a chief flight instructor for Flight Discovery as a Type 1 or Class 1 flight instructor, and they needed that. So I needed multi-engine time, and they needed a flight instructor to run their flight school. Pardon me. So I used that to get into my multi-engine flying.
Yeah. Okay. So you started teaching. You started teaching at your school as a multi-engine instructor then?
No, actually, I went there to instruct all their single-engine stuff and tail draggers and such. And but they had multi-engine. They did mostly charter and a little bit of teaching. So I told them I would oversee the school for them and their flight instructors as their chief flight instructor. But my flying, I said I really needed to just fly airplanes and not instruct at the moment. And they took me on for that. And I was to fly their their twin engines that they had at the time.
Right. Okay. Cool. So that was like the first position then. After that, I guess, what was the bridge between that job and then what you were doing right now, currently flying like the 604?
Oh, gosh. That job up there led to, because I'd taken so long, I instructed for 7 or 8 years, and I enjoyed all those years. I just felt that I needed a change. And I also enjoyed that adventure of traveling. So when I was in Whitehorse, the industry kind of kicked off, and I don't know what year that was. I want to say early 90s at this point, mid 90s maybe. The industry had started kicking off. It's one of those times where there was lots of hiring. And my former students back in Ontario were calling me. We didn't have internet. We didn't have Facebook. So I don't know how we kept in touch, but we kept in touch a little bit. And I was getting phone calls from former students that were working, flying these turboprops in back in London and Toronto, Ontario, doing air ambulance and charters. And they'd called me for quite a while, whiles and Whitehorse, saying that there's lots of jobs and I could come down and get one anytime. I told my boss in Whitehorse that I guess the industry was taking off, just over a beer or something, just chatting. I'm getting a lot of calls from down south. He wasn't sure if his company was going to be in business the next spring. Gold prices at the time were very low. That was a lot of the charter flying. So he encouraged me, if I was going to get a job, if there's jobs available, that he actually encouraged me to go take the job because he didn't know he'd be in business. So that was
really cool. Yeah,
it's really cool. He was a really nice guy. Jamie Tate's his name. He used to own a company called Summit Air. They got bought out by another company, but it was nice advice. I took him for his word and decided I guess I need to go back home to Ontario. And that got me into the turboprops, flying lots of twin-engine turboprops. And that led to the airline because that kind of experience leads to an airline job. And I think I was one of the last people, I'm pretty sure I was one of the last couple of people hired at Air Ontario, which is one of the forerunners of Jazz. And I know I'm one of the last because during my grad school, the merger happened between all the four regional properties that ultimately became the name of Air Canada Jazz.
Oh, wow. So you're like one of the first hires at Jazz then, kind of in a way.
Like yeah, I guess
that's company, where I ended. Yeah.
Yeah. It went through some names, but yeah, that's where I ended up. I did a few years flying those turboprops, and I really enjoyed that work. It was.
Can you touch on what kind of airplanes those were at the time? Like what you were flying?
Yeah, mostly I flew their Piper Cheyennes, which are like a light version of a King Air.
Yeah, that sounds familiar.
Yeah, it's got a PT-6. There's a lot of them in Ontario, less of them outside. But we had Piper Cheyennes. There's a different models of Cheyenne 2, a 2XL, which is a bit longer. And then they have a Piper Cheyenne 3, which is a T-tail, very similar to a King Air 350, I suppose. It flies in the 30,000s and does a pretty decent speed. So I flew all those aircraft types, doing air ambulance and charters on those for several years.
Fun, yeah. Do you have any like crazy stories and stuff or interesting stories flying those around Ontario, or did you meet any like influential people in your time?
Well, I really enjoyed flying them. A lot of people did not enjoy air ambulance flying. It's usually at night, it's usually last minute. You're very often going up to some sort of a gravel strip in northern Ontario and bringing people back.
Right.
I always looked at it as helping people. So, it's pretty tough conditions out there in the winter, picking people up and bringing them south to the hospitals. So there's some pretty gnarly experiences up there, flying into these dark hole approach very much exists in the north because it's dark everywhere except for that rectangle that you're landing on.
Yeah.
So some sketchy runways, but the turboprops are excellent, perfect airplane for those. Later flying a Dash 8, which is just a bigger version of the same thing. I felt very comfortable transitioning to Jazz's Dash 8s because they're just terrific aircraft for those type of operations. Dash 8s don't do the air ambulance, but so I suppose there was lots of different close calls as I'm learning my way doing that. But, from icing to winter operations and having to take care of your own airplane. And I think someone mentioned, I think it was Graham mentioned putting your airplane to bed at night so it's there for you in the morning, taking batteries out and bringing them with you into your hotel room, somewhere warm so that your airplane might start the next morning.
Yeah.
Waiting for the airplane, which gets cold soaked, waiting for it to warm up after you've got the battery back in it and de-iced the whole thing, because your instruments need to be at some sort of operating temperature as well. So it was a lot of challenging stuff during that time.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah. So then you started with Air Ontario or Jazz. How many years did you stay there? And then I guess you must have decided that you needed to change again, huh? Because you moved on to, I guess ultimately you're doing charters again. So,
yeah. So my Jazz years, we'll call them, it was 5 or 6 years. It spanned through 9/11 because I'm that old. So I was operating aircraft. I ended up at the Halifax base prior to 9/11. In ground school, somebody who was hired for Air Nova didn't want to go to Halifax. And since we had merged during my ground school, he had wrangled it that he could take Toronto base. And he mentioned that I would go to Halifax to the chief pilot, which I'd never said. But my wife actually went to college in Halifax. She went to university there. So she was happy to go back to Halifax. So we ended up in Halifax and flying the Maritimes and into Quebec through 9/11. And I forget the question now. What was the answer? What was the question?
I was just asking you, I guess like you were saying, you had a couple of years at Jazz, but now you're flying the 604. So I was wondering like kind of what the change was, or when you decided that you needed to change again, kind of move on from the airlines. Or... Yeah, no, it's okay.
Yeah, it was a weird time. And I realized this in hindsight, being at Jazz, it was a merger of properties, of four different properties. And that was, I guess you would call it an unhappy time for pilots and flight attendants. I'll just talk to the pilot side of it. Because you have years of service, as has been mentioned before, and everyone knows seniority is king at airlines. So you have this seniority-based new conglomerate of four private or individual airlines now called Jazz. And the senior guys all seem to be out west. They'd been with their companies longer than the young upstart Air Nova, which is where I ended up being based. So there was a lot of people taking captain's roles from the west moving east. And so there was a lot of unhappiness, not for me, I was a new hire. I was just happy to be there. The training is exceptional. The aircraft equipment is great. The infrastructure's really good, but the morale was super low even before 9/11. And then through 9/11, which I was still there, the pilot morale continued to drop off because of all the security measures and just that whole unrest throughout that time. We also went into bankruptcy protection at Jazz, Air Canada as well, I suppose, which I suppose, I don't know the hierarchy of it all. So bankruptcy protection, it was fairly certain I was going to be laid off, being such a new hire prior to that. And I was now already in Quebec City. My base had closed, and I was forced to Quebec City quite happily in a way, because Quebec City is wonderful, and I was now living in Quebec City. I was never a commuter guy. I was always going to live there, had a young family. So we're in Quebec City, and the layoff was going to come. I wasn't bilingual yet. I was learning French. I have my high school French. We all do,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
It wasn't going to get me a job. We were pumping gas in Quebec City. So luckily for me, my former employer was looking for me. I didn't know that. The one I was flying turboprops with. My former employer, the owner, he had tasked somebody with the job of finding me, which wasn't very easy because there's no social media. And they found me in Quebec City somehow through friends, I guess, and they offered me my job back, knowing that I was going to be laid off.
Oh, there you go.
So that's how I got back into doing charters and air ambulance. But what happened while I was gone for those years at Jazz, that company had gotten jets. So on top of being asked to come back, I got a leave of absence from Jazz. They're offering special leave of absences, which allowed me to keep my medical, my travel, and, of course, my seniority if I would just leave, because they were trying to get rid of people off their roster, off their payroll. So I took the maximum three-year leave and went back to the corporate world. And during that 3 years, I became a chief pilot for these guys. And for that former company, and I started flying their jets as well, starting off on a Falcon 10, a Dassault product. They make these Falcons. And so I was flying Falcon 10. I was chief pilot for all the turboprops, flying the turboprops, having a great time. until my 3-year leave came up, and then I had to go back to my airline job. So I did, because I kind of still thought the airlines were the way to go, for the financial and the full outlook of things. And there's a bit of a lifestyle situation at the airlines that corporate cannot give you. Mm-hmm. But I went back to the airlines. I started flying the RJ, as now based in Toronto, which luckily is where this company had me anyway. I was in London, but now I was based in Toronto with the airline. And I kept working. I did have permission from both Jazz and my union. You have to get both approvals to keep working at the corporate as I was working at Jazz.
Both. The mix going. You're doing both at the same time.
Yeah. Because as you know, the nice thing about airlines is you get 8 to 10 days off a month. And those are written in stone, so you can take those days off. And in my case, I went and did some corporate flying on the side. And so I kind of did both for a while until I guess I just realized, I think I was offered something. I was lured back to the corporate by more pay and more equipment. And I was already flying the RJ in a type of RJ. The corporate version of an RJ-200 is a Challenger 850, and this company ultimately got a Challenger 850, which is made in the factory to be corporate version of the RJ-200. So I ended up flying that, and that's when I left Jazz and went back to the corporate. So that was over 20 years ago, but that's what I did. That's how I ended up back in corporate, and that was about it. I think once you leave an airline job, you're not going to get back to an airline. They think perhaps you don't like airline work, so I don't think I could ever go back. Nor do I want to. I enjoy my corporate flying.
Yeah, for sure. I guess another question that came to mind when I was hearing that. So you said you had a small family at the time too. Do you want to describe what life's like kind of working a corporate job and then having a family at the same time?
Yeah. So the having a family and the corporate. Well, it is the truth about corporate flying in Canada for certain. U.S. has everything better. The U.S. guys make better pay, and I'm going to assume they have better days off. But I only know the Canadian side. So the one difference between corporate and airline, of course, is schedule. And in Canada, until December 12th of this year, things are about to change, and it's going to be for the better because we have new fatigue rules in Canada, which are already at the airline level, but are now coming to what the level I fly at. It's a corporate, the commuter level, which in the CARS regulations is 704. And I also fly in the private regulations, which are CARS 604. But the fatigue rules are gonna cause them to have more pilots. So I think things in our schedule is gonna change. But initially flying corporate with a young family means you'll be away more than you would at the airline. You'll certainly be on call more. It really depends on the department you're working for, which company you're working for. Because I was chief pilot, I was wearing two hats, chief pilot and flying the jets. I was very busy, probably too busy for a young family. The way I handled that was I definitely gave up all the things I would normally do, being on baseball teams and doing anything else outside of flying and working, and then I freed up all my other time to be with my family. So that was one way I coped. And then ultimately I realized that corporate, wearing all those hats they allow you to wear in corporate, I decided I should probably dial it back to spend more time with the family. So I gave up being chief pilot and went back to just being a pilot, which helped a lot. Holding a manager position in the corporate world is giving up a lot of your time. There's some perks to it. I estimated that the perks weren't worth the time I was giving up. So that's how I coped.
Yeah. Sorry to interrupt you, but, that's kind of interesting too. I don't think I've ever talked to someone who has been a chief pilot. Do you want to touch on what that role is like and kind of what that job entailed if you can?
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. It was, it almost was like flight instructing, with the difference being you're dealing with pilots that were already experienced. So when we hired pilots, we needed them to have at least 500 hours of multi-engine time from somewhere. It could be turboprop, could be piston engine. And we required that so that we could do air ambulance flying with them, which was a Government of Ontario requirement for safety. So I got to hire these motivated commercial multi-engine IFR pilots, and we kind of take them to the next level as far as standard operating procedures and the mentality that they should have. Because a lot of times we'd be hiring guys from the north, not to say that they don't operate safely up there, but there's a get the job done mentality, whereas our mentality was safety first for our contracts. We're flying corporations such as GM. In our jets, we're flying people like the rich and famous people of the world. So we definitely, safety was first, and there was no Bush mentality. So I enjoyed the part of being chief pilot where I got to mentor these pilots into a more professional maybe way of doing things. And also knowing that anyone on our turboprops, if they weren't going to go onto our jets, were certainly going to go onto the airlines. And I'd already been at the airlines, so I was able to give them advice toward that. And I think we had maybe 30 or so turboprop pilots, probably more, that were under my umbrella as the chief pilot. Wow. And so they would come and go, and I made it very open that they could tell me if they were getting a job at Jazz, which is someone who took a lot of our pilots, so that I would know I could hire somebody and keep the stream going. And there'd be nothing detrimental to them if they said they were going to try and get a job with Jazz. Most of our pilots would hang in until they got a job with Jazz or a job on our jets. They wouldn't just go laterally to another charter company. We were a pretty big and pretty good company to work for. So I enjoyed that being chief pilot. There was very few times I needed to discipline anybody, and even fewer times I had to fire anybody. So that worked out really well.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. I guess another question that came to mind there when you're bringing that up, I guess at that time you've seen the kind of progression towards like safety over time. I know talking to some other people that definitely back in the day, it was kind of like, if you can't do it, then why do I hire you kind of mentality, right? So do you want to talk and speak on that, like how that's changed over time and what you've seen there?
Yeah, so I started in the 1980s and the theories were already there in the 1980s, but in practice, it takes a long time for the industry to pick up what's being laid out by Transport Canada, I think, and carry it to heart. So what we have now, of course, is crew resource management. These are the result of accidents, essentially. And there was an accident in Dryden, Ontario, when they first started flying jets. I can't remember the jet, sorry, off the top of my mind, but there was an accident. It was Air Canada Jazz, or Air Ontario, I should say. An Air Ontario accident, and there were flight attendants on board, of course. There was traveling pilots in the back passenger compartment, and there were pilots up front. And the reason I mention that is that nowadays, it's the whole crew. Even a deadheading pilot who's simply just in the back catching a lift for work from one station to another, everybody's part of the crew, and the crew up front, the pilot, and then the pilot in command, the captain, all need to listen to the entire crew for safety. In the case of that Air Ontario accident, it was a contaminated wing. Turboprops and piston engine aircraft, we used to talk about how much snow and ice they could carry and still take off. It's shocking to think about today, because today it's totally the clean aircraft or the clean wing concept. In fact, it's the clean aircraft concept. But it was still and it's still coming along. That concept was there, but yet they started flying jets at Air Ontario, and there's still some of that mentality about, oh, a little bit of snow or ice on the wing will be okay. And of course, we know that's not okay. And in that type of aircraft, it was obviously fatal to have any snow or ice. So, but people noticed it in interviews afterwards. The flight attendants had noticed the ice. The traveling pilot had noticed the ice, but it was ingrained that no, the guys up front have it under control. So what I've seen is there's more acceptance for the crew up front to accept input from everybody. And that's what we instilled at my former company where I was chief pilot, because we would have medics or we'd have even a passenger that was concerned. We didn't have that many passengers. We'd have like a maximum, say, 8 passengers on these small turboprops. So if anyone had any concern, we would address it. And we wouldn't be taking off with contaminated wings. Luckily, we all learned that that issue in the industry. But for any number of reasons, we'll definitely take into account people's input. So there, I think we've gone away from if you won't do it, the pilot right next to you will do it mentality. Yeah. And that's obviously for the better.
Yeah, no, I agree with you 100%. I guess like another thing I wanted to ask you is flying private charters and stuff like that. What's like one of your favorite aspects of that? Like flying private versus like airlines and stuff like that. Like, is there like, for someone who doesn't know a lot about it, but is interested in getting involved in like private aviation, is there like a lot of spontaneous trips, like last minute things, like random charters, or do you kind of have a general gist going into your work weeks, I guess, of where you're going?
It's a combination of both. Charter in or private jets in Canada, you'll have private owners that don't charter their plane and they give you their schedule for the whole entire year, with the exception of any kind of pop-ups for, you know, medical emergencies or family emergencies. But in the charter world, it is a lot of pop-up stuff. When I'm on call without any trips, so if I start a Monday a shift and there's no trips booked, that week I could end up anywhere in the world, literally anywhere in the world. You just don't know. So as you're on call spending time, you kind of keep in touch with what's going on in the world. You look at where the hurricanes and the typhoons are, or the world conflicts are, airspace issues. Obviously, we have a lot of those right now with Russia and North Korea, and even going past China with the China Strait. So we look at the political stuff when you're on days off, just, you know, roughly thinking about it. But you hone in on it once you're given a trip, because we can get a trip to Asia pretty quickly. And we used to stop in Russia for a fuel stop. And a Challenger 604, we're not required to. We can fly past their airspace and land in Japan. But you're still right beside the airspace. So, it's, you know, stuff you consider. But I do like I could end up anywhere. I could be cutting my lawn in the morning and planning a trip to, you know, anywhere, to Costa Rica in the afternoon.
Yeah.
So
coming from my perspective, I think that's like probably one of the most fascinating things. I think that's kind of what got me involved in aviation in the beginning. It was just like that idea of like how fast you can travel the world and get from one point to another. Is that something that kind of intrigues you and it still like excites you, I guess? Or has that just become super normal for you now, and like all the last minute spontaneous trips? Or is there ever a time when you're like, wow, this is pretty cool that I'm going across the planet here and I just found out about it a couple hours ago?
Yeah, it's still pretty cool, even at 55 years old, and I've been doing the corporate stuff for the last 20 years. So of 20 years, I've had of the lots of spontaneous trips that pop up. And almost always some are really cool. Very often somewhere I've never been before. So on top of having a procedure or a protocol that I've created to make sure I do things correctly when I'm going somewhere brand new, there's a lot of resources now on the internet, which I didn't have starting out or even 20 years ago. There's just a lot of great resources. Ops Group, for example, if you're going to an airport, there's a website it's the Ops Group, and there's a input from planners and pilots around the world. And they can go, you can type in an airport and you get this spy view, they call it, of the airport, right down to the operators you'll get fuel from. So it's still exciting. And, you know, you'll be, like I say, cutting your lawn in the morning and you're somewhere in Central America in the afternoon and you're in your cab heading to a hotel thinking, it's still a bit mind-blowing, to be honest.
Yeah.
In a good way. It's still excellent. I love it.
Yeah. So I guess like one part we skipped there was you said you got your job back with that company out of Ontario with the turboprops, working for them. How did you make that connection with the job you have right now out in Victoria? And then, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah. The connection to being in Victoria now, I enjoyed my flying in Ontario. It's so busy. There's a lot of corporate aviation. So as much as you're tied to an airplane and people can sell the airplane, so your job could kind of disappear. So that can be unnerving. But as you move along your career, you have more experience. You lose that unnerveness. That's not even a word. You lose that concern because you know that you'll find another airplane. So being in Toronto, there's always another corporate aircraft. And you do get to know the other corporate departments and pilots. Toronto, there was a lot of sub charters. So when we get so busy in Toronto before the 2008 financial setback, which was caused by the housing industry. Anyway, the subprime stuff. Anyway, the 2008 collapse, up till then, we were so busy, we were doing other people's flying for them as well. And it was collegial, even though it was competitive. But eventually, it was really we had been back in Ontario for 10 years. I've been flying with this company for more than 10 years, if you count the before and after and during Jazz time. But it was 10 years solid of corporate flying. I'd already given up my chief pilot gig, which helped the family lifestyle. But I kind of got into a lifestyle vibe, I think. And my wife's from British Columbia, and she really wanted to go back to British Columbia. So I would just look on AF Canada for jobs, just as you do. I think a lot of pilots do that as a hobby. And I saw this job in Victoria flying a Challenger 604. I was flying the Challenger 850. It's different type rating, so I'd have to do an initial type rating, but with all the other types I've had at that point, I guess they gave me an interview and I got the job. I didn't know anybody at the company. It was based solely on my experience and my resume, I suppose. At this point, I don't know how many hours I had, but I think I was fairly experienced, and I don't know what their pile of experience looked like. And this was 2011. So we're coming out of the downturn of 2008, but there was still probably a little, I don't really know. I can't remember what the industry was like, but I did know I wanted to be in BC, and Victoria specifically was great for my wife because her brother lives there. So we tried to get the job and eventually got the job. So,
yeah, no, there you go. Perfect. I guess working out of Victoria, what's that like? Like doing all the charters? I know going on their website, your company's website, like they're constantly selling like the single leg trips, like the empty legs and stuff like that, from like Hawaii and all these like tropical destinations. Do you want to speak on like flying out of Victoria and some of the coolest trips you have to do out of there?
Yeah, I've really enjoyed the company and the flying out of Victoria. I don't foresee ever wanting to leave. I think they're getting a snowstorm today. I'm not at home, so I didn't have to do the digging, but I understand you're getting some pictures, snow.
Yeah.
I enjoy the flying. The flying is just as varied and yet different. Toronto flying was a lot of going to Teterboro, New York area, which is like driving your airplane into a traffic jam when you go up to Northeast USA and they get bad weather. And just to take a slight at them, it's like they don't realize they get winter in Northeastern USA as far as how to look after their airports. and then a lot of Florida and a lot of Bahamas. But from the West Coast, Victoria base, it's a lot of Hawaii and it's a lot of California. And I'll take both those destinations over New York and Florida any day. Yeah. And so the destinations are really great. We still come into Canada. The company that I work for has operations for helicopters in St. John's, Newfoundland. So I think that may be one reason why they even got a fixed wing aircraft, because they're a helicopter company. Even though I don't fly helicopters, we now have two Challengers. My Challenger mostly was to get them from Victoria to St. John's nonstop for work reasons and chartered out in between those trips. So we still go to St. John's, which is a great city and then a great province to go out to Newfoundland and Labrador. And we do a lot of Toronto, Montreals, and but really California and flying to Hawaii is pretty great.
Yeah, no, that's really, really cool. That's that's just mind blowing. That's like exactly kind of right now where I'm at right now. That's the kind of career I would hope to get later down the line, like flying that jet all around stuff. Like every time I see it, that's kind of why I wanted to get you on, right? I've seen that jet taking off and where it's going on Flight Radar. I'm like, that's so cool. Dream position for so many people, I imagine.
Yeah, it's still very cool, even, after years and years of doing it and, over 10 years, the same airplane, but that airplane is so well maintained and every few years they put new paint on it, check the interior, upgrade the interior. So it's like a new airplane all the time. we get people on that airplane that charter other Challengers and the newer models of Challenger, and they're always surprised that ours is not a brand new airplane just based on the maintenance that we do to it. So flying the Challenger, it's, you know, flying that Falcon 10 in the early days was exciting as a pilot's perspective, but a Falcon 10 is a very small jet, and you almost have to apologize as people hunch over and kind of crawl into their seats. But a Challenger, people walk onto a Challenger, it's as expansive, as big as an airline. There's no hunching over, and it's just gorgeous inside, and there's no apologies you need to make, and it performs very well, and the range is exceptional. We do Victoria to Panama nonstop, and vice versa. We do Victoria to Costa Rica nonstop, and of course we go to Hawaii nonstop because there's no option. So it has these a great range, and there's aircraft with greater ranges, but that seems to be, we take it to its maximum range on these trips, and it's very comfortable traveling for people. So it's exciting. Yeah,
there you go. What is like a piece of advice you'd give a student pilot that's looking to get into private aviation down the line, like a position that you're in right now, similar to that? If you could give kind of like some tips for somebody coming up to the industry right now, that'd be awesome.
Yeah, I think I've always told people, students and young guys, it's all young, not guys, but young pilots, that it's the connections you make. I probably wouldn't have gotten my jobs that kept my career moving without the students I taught. And that's partly because I stayed in instructing for so long, and my students moved along in the industry. They went into multi-engine and got those jobs. And ultimately drew me
back. I guess, sorry to interrupt you, but yeah, I guess your students kind of got you that multi-engine job in Ontario initially too, right? From what I heard there.
100%. Yeah. And that I was to be flying multi-engines in Whitehorse, but the two multi-engines I was supposed to be flying in Whitehorse had issues, the issues being that they both crashed before I got to fly them. Minor crashes, but I was not able to fly them. So my real multi-engine flying, my turboprop flying, was which started the whole career, that it really is by pay and lifestyle, you need to be flying turboprops for the most part, unless you're going to fly floats. And I'm not sure, you should get a Harbor Air guy on here, because I'm really interested in those guys' career paths.
I'm hoping to get one of them on, 100%.
Yeah, that's I see them flying, and that's pretty idyllic to me. It's like, oh, you just get to cruise around. I know they fly in some minimum weather, that's just float flying, but... my students got me that turboprop job, and without that job, I don't get the airline job. And in fact, it was a former student that was a recommendation to get my Air Ontario job. She was a dispatcher, but I say I wouldn't have gotten that job without her recommend. And I wouldn't have gotten the job that got me into the airline without my students' recommend. So you just don't know who's going to help you along the way. I was surprised I got both those jobs. And so I guess my advice is not to just to keep in touch with people. Like, it's so much easier today than it would have been back in my day. But to keep in touch with your group of pilots that are coming up, and or in my case, my students were the ones who got me my jobs. My peers, a lot of people fall out of aviation. They have other interests that seem probably financially more stable, maybe more interesting to them. So a lot of my peers where I was a flight instructor with in Ontario, I can't think of any of them that are flying for a living still, with the exception of the one person that hired me, and he's at Transport Canada. So not technically flying for a living, but still in the industry. It's for me, it'd be people in your ground school. It'd be the people that you work with coming up. If you work on the ramp at flying club, those people are going to help you get your next job probably.
Yeah, it just always goes back to networking, it seems like, right?
I guess so.
Biggest thing. Yeah, 100%. Could you take me through what 1 month maybe looks like flying for the company you're currently at, or just in private aviation in general? Like what your schedule looks like? Because I know it's different for a lot of people, but I'm just curious to see you flying the 604 jet, what your a month in your life looks like right now.
Yeah. The It does vary. What we at the corporate world lack is a real hard schedule. And it, like I say, I think that's going to change come December 12th, just passed, as they kind of figure out what to do about our new fatigue rules, which are great. The fatigue rules are going to limit how much you can fly if you start in the early morning hours. And in Canada, generally speaking, we've had the most liberal duty rules of the world. And we're kind of catching up to the rest of the world by limiting how much pilots will fly. If you start before 6 a.m. or if you're working at 3 in the morning, you can't work 14 hours any longer like we just always used to do. So with the changes probably coming, I think we're going to have to hire more pilots. And with more pilots, we'll have a better schedule. Not exactly airline better, but better. But a typical month, I'm going to look at my month here real quick. And a typical month is not necessarily knowing your trips, but we put ourselves on call, or the person who makes the schedule creates an on call. It's very personal. So on my plane, there's three main pilots. We have a backup pilot who's a manager. He's our ops manager, and he can kind of sub in, but he doesn't hold a on call position. But if we look at the month and we all need certain times off, we tap him and he'll come in and cover trips or just cover on-call periods, which when we're on-call, you still get the pop-up trip. I've had a pop-up trip to Hawaii where an aircraft went mechanical in Vancouver, and I was on my roof at the time cleaning my gutters, and I got a call from work saying that we need you to come to work. And we have an on-call. So my schedule is laid out. Let's go back to the schedule. The schedule is laid out where we were always trying to do 12 days on call, 6 days off, which would cover our former regulations. So that's how my month would look. So in a month, you would end up with 8 or 10 days off in a calendar month.
That's pretty nice.
In theory, that's what you had.
Yeah, in theory, for sure.
You'd be working through the weekends or on call through the weekends. So you never really know what day of the week it is because you're just always working, it seems. But you know, you have your time off. And the problem with our corporate world is the lack of pilots we have per airplane. And if a trip extends by a day or two, as we get these pop-up trips, and it starts to straddle 2 days into your on-call, into your days off, someone's got to give. So you always have to be flexible in and around your on-call period. Because if you're on a trip that leaves for 6 or 7 days, and you were supposed to be off for two of those, either you need to work an extra 2 days and hope to get it back later, or someone has to come in and work the beginning of that trip. Because again, you're only working with three pilots, and if you sit down and do the math, that doesn't really work out so well. You need almost five pilots per airplane to have an airline type schedule. And that's probably still quite minimum if someone's sick. And today, someone's sick if they have COVID, or if they're a little bit sick, we don't come to work sick like we used to. So our schedule is laid out 12 and 6, I'll say. But there's a required flexibility that's not written down anywhere, but it's assumed, I guess you would say.
Yeah, that makes sense, though. Yeah.
So that's the way that works. When I was on the roof, I was actually on a day off. And I was on a day off on the roof cleaning my gutter, as you do, and they actually couldn't reach the guy who was on call that day. When we're on call, we're not on call to be wheels up in 30 minutes or 60 minutes like my old air ambulance days. On call for us means if you can make it to the airport, I think it's 2 or 3 hours. So, you know, that's in Victoria, that's not hard to do. I only live 15 minutes away from the airport. So they called the guy on call, and they couldn't reach him quick enough. So they called me, that's a Hail Mary, and I happened to pick up. And there you were. I was on the roof at the time, and the next thing I know, I was flying to Hawaii.
Yeah, that's so awesome. Yeah, really cool. I mean, this is kind of a unique question, but it's something I really kind of want to learn more about. I'm curious about like the economic side of like chartering these private aircraft and stuff. Like, sure. For example, when these, I see a lot of those like empty leg trips and stuff like that. I'm just curious about like how that works. Like, does the initial customer who's like chartering that, does he kind of pay like a premium, I guess, for his one-way leg, knowing that you guys are gonna have to take the aircraft back and might not be able to fill it? Or if you could kind of just explain how that process works, that'd be awesome.
Yeah, the unique thing about what they're doing at my company is these one-way legs, which has always sort of been implied, but now we're advertising it. When before 2008, we would do trips within trips back in Toronto, and we would fly someone to New York, and they'd have to pay the round trip cost, but we would always be able to fill up the empty legs, and all that money would go to the company. I don't think we'd ever give anything back to the customer, nor would they expect anything. What these one-way legs at my current company, the difference is we are giving back to the initial charter customer. So when they book a trip, sometimes they book it to book the one-way trip, but the initial booking, they if they really want to go to Hawaii, a lot of them are to Hawaii, as you can see on the website. And during the hot season, which starts now, really, there's always someone coming and someone going. And if you're flexible on your time, you could get the one-way leg. But if you really just want to go a certain time, then you're going to pay the round-trip cost of that trip because we just don't leave our airplane somewhere. So you hope that we're going to fill the one-way leg. And when we do, we pay you back. And I'm not sure the exact...
That's interesting.
So these are, you know, well-off people who can afford the round trip, but they would love not to pay the empty leg back if they could.
No kidding.
And we come back because we have other trips. Sometimes we have another trip right back to Hawaii. Sometimes we have a trip to Montreal. So we need to come back to our home base where we base all our trips out of. But we earnestly try to fill those empty legs. Through our website, but also through another system called SketAero, where they know our airplane's on the ground, and then all the brokers of the world know our airplane is a certain location. I'm not sure how that works. I don't do the billing or the booking, but when we're sitting in Montreal, my airplane currently is, brokers know my airplane's in Montreal. If they suddenly need an airplane in that vicinity, they'll call my company, and the person who does our booking will, you know, try and book that trip. So that's how it works. And in our case, we give back what we're earning or a portion or a large portion of it back to the original booking client. And then everyone benefits. The person getting the one-way trip benefits. The person suddenly gets a huge discount off his trip. And that's the best we can do. And it's really helped our business. We're busier since the pandemic anyway. We're almost three times busier now than we used to be.
Wow.
Part of it's this one-way thing. Part of it's this the folks that were on that bubble, we'll say, who are maybe taking first class. But, of course, being on the island, as we are, that means going to Vancouver, Seattle. That means a connection time. So those folks that were on the bubble are realizing the benefits of private travel and the benefits of sharing the cabin. We seat 10 people very comfortably in that Challenger 604. In some cases, they share the cabin. They'll meet each other the day of, and we introduce them, and we kind of coordinate that. We know the personalities that might get along, and we just say, if you're interested, these two people would travel with your group of four, plenty of room for everybody, and so they also share their costs that way. And that's kept us really busy.
Yeah, that's really cool. I guess I never thought of that, too, like people sharing the cabin. I never really considered that, but I guess that could be a possibility as well.
It's like taking an airline, but it's all first class and you still drive up right to the airplane. And honestly, if I will never have the wealth to do this, but if I had the wealth, that's the way to go. By the time you land in Maui, for example, from Victoria on a private jet versus taking the airline, you'll have barely taken off out of Vancouver or Seattle by the time I've got you landed and on your way to your home in Maui. There's that big a difference, even on a long leg trip like that. If you consider the check-in time and then the layover times and then the waiting for your baggage at the other end, versus driving up to your airplane and having your car meet you at your airplane in Maui. You get almost an extra day's of vacation by traveling this way.
Exactly. No, that's something you always got to account for when you're flying like these airline trips. It's like pretty much an entire day, right? Just for commuting and traveling and stuff like that. So yeah, no, that makes sense. Another question, I guess you saying that you kind of know the personalities and stuff like that. Do you find that you kind of get a unique experience like getting to interact with these people? And kind of, is there like regular customers that you've kind of built a relationship with or anything like that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So the customers, we don't have a cockpit door on Challengers or any corporate aircraft. We sort of do, but it's not a locked ballistic door like the airline. So some people are surprised that they can actually see and talk to the pilots during our flight. And they're welcome to, because we know who we're flying. There's no mystery people really. But yeah, you interact with them for sure. On a long flight, you're as a pilot with the autopilot on and cruise, you're still going to get up and stretch your legs. You're still going to get up and use the facilities or make yourself a coffee. So, or the people come to the front and talk to you. So year in, year out, we see a lot of people at the same time. And, yeah, there's a lot of interaction, and essentially you're working for them, but there's a friendship to it all as well. And you know a lot about them and their families and or their employees that you're flying around. So that's really a nice part about it. They're not just passengers. There's people you know, and you know what they like. You know, half of them I know how they take their coffee. So we have a flight attendant on board, or actually we have a different term for it at the charter world, but essentially a flight attendant that's looking after all that. But you definitely get to know them personally.
Yeah, no, that's kind of nice to hear, because that's kind of the way I assumed it'd be watching some. I mean, it's pretty interesting now. There's a lot of people on YouTube and stuff who share their experience, right? Like flying for corporate companies and stuff like that. And
it's kind of
what's shared with people is like, yeah, you get those interactions. So I thought that was always really cool. I guess we've already hit an hour here. It goes by fast. So I'm kind of trying to keep them around there. So I'll just go into some like outro questions I usually ask everyone at the end of the episode.
Sure.
Yeah. So can you name, I mean, this might be challenging. It's probably a challenging for you, but can you name all the aircraft you've flown in your career? And of those, what was your favorite?
100%, I could not name all the aircraft I fly. but there's been a lot. There has been, most of the single engine anythings. I've probably flown from Moonies to the Barons to the Cessna products and the Piper products, of course. Being a flight instructor, you're often either flying and training in those at school, or someone buys one and they just need your experience to help them learn their own airplane. And you kind of learn it together, but they either need it for insurance reasons, or they need it because you specifically have experience on that airplane. Tailwheel aircraft have always been my favorite, because you're flying those right to the moment you tie them down at the end. I did a lot of training on the tailwheel aircraft. The Malls and the Super Cubs and the Piper Cubs and my favorite, the Fleet Canuck, because it's Canadian. If I was picking a small aircraft favorite, the Fleet Canuck. It just flies so beautifully, and it's just a piece of history, and it's so relaxing to fly. I still enjoy flying small aircraft today. If I had access to a Fleet Canuck, which I don't, I would seek that out and rent or buy one of those. And then in the jet world, which is where all the type ratings go, and I have quite a few of those at this point. The current airplane I'm flying, I love flying it. It's so comfortable as a pilot, situational awareness, customer comfort in the back, a capability of the aircraft, the redundancy and triple systems that surround you on a day's work. It feels great. My very first jet, I loved it as a pilot, that Dassault Falcon 10. The same people that build that built the French Mirage fighter jet. And I think they built that Falcon 10 like a fighter jet, so you felt like you're flying one. It has leading edge device that comes out. So it's really cool, man. It went fast. It flew fast. It had leading edge devices on the wing, which changed the shape of the wing, allow you to land in relatively short runways. But then you take off from a short runway and be flying like as fast as you can fly, really. And I used to fly someone around. That's all he wanted, just fly it as fast as it can go. We had several of them at this company, and I flew the owner of one of them, and his request was always fly fast.
Nice. There you go.
And secondly, fly safe, he would say.
Yeah. Yeah, that must be like a super fascinating thing too. I've always wondered, like even seeing like all those Bombardiers and Gulfstreams taking off from YYJ, just like the distance it takes them to take off and then the speed they're going always blows my mind. Like they're up and gone like so fast, and like the climbing rate just seems ridiculous. Like, it's so fascinating. I'm so jealous that you get to fly those all the time. That's awesome.
Yeah, it's a super fun thing to do. And I think there's not a single aircraft type I've not enjoyed flying. I've liked everything I've flown.
Nice. Good answer. What's the next question here? Favorite airport you have visited? Can you name like an airport out of all the places you've gone and traveled? Could be super small airport, bigger one. Is there any one that kind of rings a bell when somebody asks you that?
Yeah, I think if I answered a favorite airport to fly into is likely Kona Airport on the Big Island of Hawaii. I was just there. We often land during the daytime, but as it turned out, we were doing back-to-back Hawaiis. We had a crew swap in Victoria. So I was on the crew that landed at night into Kona a couple of weeks ago, just when the volcano was erupting in Kona. No way. So we made sure there's no ash cloud, but we could see the glow of that volcano 250 miles back of Kona. And then we could see the hot red lava as we're approaching to land in Kona. And this is a nighttime landing, so it was very brilliant. And so that specifically, that approach was probably the most stunning thing I've ever seen. Also in Kona, I snapped a photo too.
That's awesome. That's so cool.
But Kona, even without the volcano going off, it's just this amazing approach. We seem to very often land to the south on runway 17. You got that beautful ocean color. You got this, is that against a dark volcanic rock that makes up a lot of Kona. And it's probably my favorite runway. It's 11,000 feet long. So as a pilot, you get 11,000 feet to land an airplane. You're pretty much going to land it fairly well. So you get to make as nice a runway as you can, or landing as you can on that length of runway. So I think Kona might be my favorite runway to go in and land on.
Yeah, no, that's fascinating. It's so lucky to get to see that volcano, though. That's insane. I'll have to have you send me that picture. That's really, really cool.
It's pretty cool.
How about a least favorite airport? Do you have one that you absolutely dread flying in and out of, or something when you hear that on the flight itinerary? You're like, oh, shoot.
Yeah. I luckily, I don't see it any longer, but I mentioned earlier, I will just go ahead and say Teterboro is my least favorite airport. It's for folks that don't know, Teterboro is where you fly into if you're a corporate airplane taking someone to New York City. Now, Teterboro is in New Jersey, but it's as close as you can land and have someone then get a limo or a helicopter if they're really balling to take their way into Manhattan. But when you land in Teterboro, you have to get below all the arrivals of JFK, LaGuardia, and what's the third airport in New York? JFK, LaGuardia.
Is it John F. Kennedy?
That's JFK. Either way, you're underneath all the other aircraft. And so they get you down low. And Teterboro is located just under a ridge. So there's this high geographical ridge, which creates all kinds of turbulence and strange wind patterns. And also they have a circling approach, which is very often an approach you need to do. So on top of everything else, you're below all these other landing aircraft at the main airports, huge airplanes that kick off all kinds of turbulence. Although I've never had wake turbulence from another aircraft there, but lots of ground turbulence, lots of noise sensitive areas, and you have to do an approach, and then you have to circle to land on another runway, which is a procedure we don't often do any longer. And that's a visual procedure. And there's, it's New York, it's Teterboro, New Jersey, everything's lit up. So you're trying to keep an eye out for this tiny little rectangle that's your runway and do some sort of a smooth approach and landing through turbulence at altitudes. And then, of course, they get winter and summertime thunderstorms, which cause all kinds of delays. And so it's tough to be on time and give a good customer experience going in and out of Teterboro, not to mention the delays you can get. So Teterboro. Yeah,
that makes
sense.
People
working there are great, don't like the airport.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. Like the big ones always seem to be a little hectic. And then, like you're saying, like the lights sometimes, like flying in certain airports at nighttime, just trying to find the runway lights in the sea of city lights, traffic lights, all that stuff. So I get that.
Yeah.
Of all the airport restaurants you've eaten at, what is your favorite? I know like I have one that comes to mind. Do you have any places you've been where it's just like outstanding food?
Outstanding food at an airport restaurant. Oh, geez. let me think. I often eat off of the airport. You know, Qualcomm Beach. Up in Qualcomm, I've had to go to a few times. I've eaten at their restaurants. I love that. I love Qualcomm Airport. That's on the island. For anyone who flies small airplanes, I recommend going to Qualcomm and going to their restaurant. It's a good restaurant. And you know it's a good restaurant. People who don't fly go to that restaurant. And it's for the people who don't fly, who just happen to be driving around Qualcomm, it's easy parking. It's not your typical airport where you have to park and pay exorbitant amounts for parking. So yeah. I think
it's funny you say that. That's my answer too.
Oh, is that right?
Qualcomm, that's my favorite place to go. Yeah, no, so far, like I just find the whole experience is pretty fun. Like landing, there's always some unique plans there, spark up some pretty interesting conversations, and then just like the whole mood and atmosphere there is a good time. So
it is. Qualcomm's got it going on. It's like an outdoor flying club full of, like you say, interesting airplanes there, interesting people, friendly people. Everyone just loves aviation when you're at that airport. Yeah, I love going up there.
Yeah. No, for sure. That's awesome. If you had to name a particular favorite flight in your career, from your Discovery flight up until your most recent flight, what would that flight be? And can you explain why it was so memorable?
Oh, my goodness. There's been a lot of interesting and memorable flights, I think. I think the most, that's a tough question. Memorable one sticks with me is when I was in Toronto working for a company and I had a pop-up trip to fly the Dalai Lama from the United States, bring him into Toronto, and he was giving a lecture or some sort of speech in Toronto. So I got to meet the Dalai Lama and fly him. Now, the flying itself was benign because it's a big corporate jet. And it was the Challenger 850, so it actually had two rooms. And the people surrounded him. There's a lot of security, for one thing. They brought dogs on. I guess I don't really know the whole situation, but there was quite a security presence prior to his arrival. And we were told by an interpreter that the Dalai Lama would like a picture with each crew member, which seemed odd. We don't take pictures. When we fly famous people, we don't whip out our cameras. We don't ask for pictures or autographs. That's sort of the unspoken rule of flying corporate. When you're flying the rich and famous, we're the break they get in their day from all of that. But we were told that he wanted pictures with us. So each crew member had to come down outside the airplane and take a picture with the Dalai Lama. And I have that picture still today. And the interpreter said that he wanted this picture, so he pretended he took a picture, but the Dalai Lama sort of grabs your arm and holds you tight, like very strong man, for a very long time, longer than it takes to snap a photo. And so I can only imagine maybe he was giving some sort of blessing before we flew him. And he did this for each of the crew members, and then we got to fly him. So that was memorable.
Wow. Yeah, that's
very interesting. And having that experience was pretty exceptional.
There you go. Perfect. Well, Rob, this is the Aspiring Pilot Podcast, where pilots come to be entertained, learn, and find inspiration. Can you provide some inspiration or advice to listeners who are working towards that dream aviation position right now?
Ooh, well, If your desire is to fly for an airline or for corporate, which seems to be the two directions people will go, I've done them both and I've enjoyed them both for different reasons. You know, I second guess my leaving the airline. When I did leave, there was no flow through to Air Canada, which they do have now. There wasn't upgrades to captain in quick order. It was a 10-year upgrade. So I still think the airline's a great job perspective. They do have a stronger schedule. They also have more pilots on their roster, so you don't feel like you definitely have to go to work every single day. You can call in sick. We don't call in sick in the corporate world. We just don't get sick, hopefully. But the advice is you can get to any of these jobs through networking, but not just for the purpose of networking, just knowing people in the industry. And I think you will have lots of setbacks, and they seem to happen in the international realm, be it a 9/11, be it a 2008 collapse of the world economy, and the pandemic. Somehow or other, and I touch wood, that I made it through all those major events still working as a pilot, where it did take out a lot of pilots who second-guessed being in the industry because they were outside of a job during those moments. Those moments, as big as they are, only last for a couple of years before we rebound. We saw that with the pandemic. Prior to the pandemic, there was a huge need for pilots, and people are getting scooped up with just simply getting the ratings, which is great. I didn't have that experience, but I don't begrudge it. People can definitely do that job. But 2 years later, I think we're right back to that today. I think there's still a huge demand, and it's happening, and it'll continue for the next few years as people like me retire early and or just anyone retiring. So the advice is stick to it. If you think that this is not a good time to get into it, there's always a good time to get into it. And you may just have to sort of suffer through some of the low times, but try to enjoy the job you're doing. I've always enjoyed my jobs. I enjoyed flight instructing. I enjoyed medevacking on a turboprop in Northern Ontario. I enjoyed my airline experience, and I certainly enjoyed my charter work. So find the thing you love. And if it's aviation, if it's being a pilot, don't make a thing you love have to be the airline job or the corporate jet job. Like I told you earlier, like the guys flying those float planes for Harbor Air, I'm sure there's career guys and gals there who love that job, and it looks like a great job too. And I always say that if I could find a career flying a Fleet Canuck, just fly a Fleet Canuck around, someone would pay me my wage today to fly a Fleet Canuck around, I think I would do that. So nice. I think that's the advice. Love every airplane you're flying. Learn it very well. I treat it like a trade. And I try to become a master craftsman of my trade because that gives me most enjoyment. And I think that's what I would recommend for people.
Yeah. No, that's a fantastic answer. That's really, really good. Well, I appreciate your time, Rob. Thanks for coming on. I think a lot of people get a lot out of this super valuable episode. So yeah, appreciate your time.
That was good talking to you. I enjoyed it.
All right. Take care.
Okay. See you now. Bye.
All right, everyone, it's Hayden. Thanks for tuning into today's episode. Hope you enjoyed the content. If you haven't already, make sure to download this episode and rate the show. You can also support myself and the show through the support link below the episode's description. Once again, as always, I hope you enjoyed this episode, and I'll see you in the next one. Bye for now.